Alaska is facing big decisions for the future. Reform is needed in the state's troubled National Guard. The budget needs to be balanced. There are also large projects on the table that would raise more revenue and lower energy costs. I'm Lori Townsend. Deficits, gas lines, hydro dams, and bridges. On November 4th, Alaskans will have to decide who can best get the job done. Sean Parnell wants to keep his job at the helm of state leadership, and he joins us today to tell us why he thinks you should vote for him. Governor Sean Parnell is our guest today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering amenities such as continental breakfast, 24-hour concierge service, and Wi-Fi. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes, or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Governor Sean Parnell is in the studio with us. His challenger, Bill Walker, will be here tomorrow for a second Talk of Alaska this week. There's lots to talk about, and you can join our conversation by calling 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Governor, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for being here today. I know that you're really busy right now and traveling around. Let's get right into some questions. Yesterday, you and the acting adjutant general, Mike Bridges, let go three top leaders in the Guard. In the past, you have said that you have control over only the top position. How did this decision come about that led to this dismissal yesterday?
Well, certainly the issues identified in the report that I asked for, when I asked the National Guard Bureau to bring in their Office of Complex Investigations, the report was pretty scathing with respect to the troops and airmen not having the trust and confidence in their leadership. And clearly that played a role in this, in that we were on the right track to getting a new permanent adjutant general in there. We've got, we put out 27 applicants for that position. We have interviews going on this week, even this morning as we speak together. So we're on track to getting a new adjutant general. But secondly, part of that means replacing the existing leadership structure. And that's what I promised. I promised a change in leadership, and that's what's being delivered.
Can you talk a bit about why those three individuals?
I can't, because it's for personnel reasons, but you know, I can tell you that it was done in full partnership with the National Guard Bureau team, with General Bridges, who's the acting adjutant general. And you know, I can't go down that road for the privacy reasons of the individuals involved, but also to you know, to thank them for their service as well. So that's the extent of what I can say.
Sure. Excuse me. Sunday, you had a meeting with Guard members.
I did.
Mm-hmm. On base. It was a private meeting. No news media was allowed. And it's my understanding that no Guard leadership was there as well. What did you come away with, Governor? Were there ideas that you think you can implement immediately, or what was the tone?
Well, this was my third town hall meeting, not my first. It was my third. I had two others several weeks back, one with an Air Guard contingent, one with Army Guard. This was primarily Army Guard, but there were some Air Guard members there as well. There were about 350 members. I asked that the leadership not be there, so that and press as well, so that the members of the National Guard that I am the commander in chief for, that the members of the Guard could speak candidly, and they did. I heard a lot of pent up frustration about the slowness of change coming, and let them know the direction we were headed, that we were following the National Guard Bureau report as a roadmap. They were not as aware as I had hoped that General Mott's team, General Mott from from Connecticut, who was the handpicked person by the National Guard Bureau to help us and walk alongside our National Guard with his team that came in. They were not as aware of their work within the Alaska National Guard right now on the ground in Anchorage, Alaska, with them, as I had hoped they would be. But I did hear a lot of pent-up frustration. I promised them that I would do everything within my power to make this right and to follow that roadmap to restore the trust and confidence of our Guard members in their Guard leadership.
Well, I certainly want to get to a wide range of other issues, but of course, this is a large and serious thing facing the state. We do have some callers on the line that we'll take. Before we take a couple of calls in this regard, this is a bit of an aside, but I'd just like your thoughts on it. The Anchorage School District has announced that they will no longer allow military recruiters of any kind on school campuses. What's your reaction to that? Do you think that is the right approach? Is it too much? Should they? What do you think about that?
Well, I think they obviously get to make their own decisions. But if it's based upon what's transpired with the National Guard, I can tell you that the recruiters who were revealed, you know, the actions were revealed and the administrative actions against them were revealed, they were removed from those positions more than 2 years ago, or about 2 years ago. So the recruiting team that is there now, I understand, is top notch and they're good people. And I don't want them smeared by the actions or alleged actions of others. And so if the ASD made that decision based upon, you know, what they perceived to be one newspaper article, which I hope they didn't, I think they were sadly mistaken. If it was based upon a broader basis for decision making, then certainly I can respect that.
Mm-hmm. Governor Sean Parnell is our guest today on Talk of Alaska, and we're taking your calls. You can join us at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or locally 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Do you anticipate there will be any criminal charges against any of the Guard members or recruiters in the future?
I do, but again, if you read the report, it's clear that the Office of Complex Investigation made several referrals to other agencies for pursuing those kinds of investigations. But again, that was already done.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a caller now who staying on this theme for just a moment. Rod in Anchorage. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. So, Governor Parnell, I was just curious. And by the way, I can understand how the National Guard personnel could be a little impatient about change. Many of them have been living with a leadership that had not been responding well for 4 years. But during that time, you had received, now the public well knows, you'd received many, many, many complaints about what was going on with the Guard. But I was just considering, you'd talked about doing some investigation. Did you ever consider bringing in your attorney general? There's a lot of power the governor has as far as investigative power. And if you did, which attorney general did you bring in to do that investigation? Thank you.
So I, number one, with every allegation that came my way, I followed that up with General Katkus and the leadership in the Guard. They assured me of the process or the path that they had followed in reporting that and investigating that. So, for example, with the sexual assault cases, in terms of with this case, we took the report. We took that then to Anchorage Police Department, for example, and that sounded eminently reasonable. The underlying question was, did I look anywhere else? And the answer is yes. For example, when I heard of specific conduct in 2010, my chief of staff went to the FBI to speak with them about the alleged conduct and asked if they would look into it. And this was, I'm not going to get into details of what that was, but they looked into allegations of misconduct. We heard back in about 4 to 6 weeks that there was no basis for the misconduct. So for the criminal allegations, there were moments when we did look outside and got that additional look. But frankly, I did the review and the investigation that I did result in 2010, 2011, and 2012 resulted in the same end result as Senator Begich experienced when he had a Guard member who works for him in his office, and who had filed, you know, a letter with my office complaining about wrongdoing in the Guard. The same Guard member actually went to work for Senator Begich. Senator Begich asked for an independent review from, I believe it was the Inspector General. The Inspector General did that in 2012, found the same thing that I did, that it appeared that every victim, for example, or every complaint of misconduct had been followed up properly by the management of the Guard at the time. So I was entirely frustrated it took so long to get to the root of it. But the positive side is we now know what the whole scope of problems are and challenges are there. We have a roadmap forward. We have some impressive people from the National Guard Bureau walking alongside our Guard members. But I can also tell you that our Guard members have been wrongly painted with this broad brush sweep that everyone is bad, when this is a small, you know, percentage of individuals who have wrongly acted against their fellow soldiers and airmen. We're going to make sure that we get to the bottom of that, punish those who need to be punished, get that done. But we're also going to install leadership and restore that trust and confidence in the Guard leadership along the way. And that's, you know, it took a long time to get here, and it wasn't 4 years. I mean, we're hearing from victims from the mid-1990s. I mean, it's been going on a long time, but it's a path of correction that I intend to take.
Excuse me. Governor, when do you think you will be making a decision about the next adjutant general?
So the interviewing group will be likely complete with their interviews this week. They'll be reviewing their choices, and I intend to, assuming I have a chance to interview folks, no decision will be made before the election, but just after the election, you know, as soon as possible. I want to just try to divorce the politics of the moment from the decision. And there has been an incredibly professional vetting process, open application saying anybody eligible can apply. General McGuire from Arizona, who is an adjutant general from there, who came in on the heels of an Office of Complex Investigation review there, you know, that revealed really challenges there. We brought him in as part of this interview team so that he knows what to look for in a new adjutant general in following a roadmap from the National Guard Bureau. And there, I want to say they'll be complete with their interviews this week. They'll forward two or three names to me for consideration. I intend to review their information, but again, no selection will be made until after November 4th.
All right. Well, we'll take one more call, and then we're going to move on to other topics. This is Pat in Anchorage. Good morning, Pat.
Yeah, good morning. As a former member of the Alaska National Guard, I think it's important to point out that the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs is unlike any other state department. As the commander-in-chief, the governor is responsible for life and death decisions when soldiers go to war. Many of the complainants have gone to war, as have I twice, and the response has been inadequate from the governor's office. We're 2 weeks away today from a gubernatorial election, and what's the real motivation here? Secondly, a prior governor had similar concerns about the Guard, and he went outside of the entire organization to find an officer who would come in without any biases. And it was an active duty officer who was promoted to general officer to come in with the right standards that need to be done. If these problems have in fact been going on for 4 years, is it more appropriate to go outside of the organization, not to those officers, of which I have been one but am no longer, who have been inside the Guard, and yet better to go outside, not just to solicit and ask for applicants, but to reach outside the organization to people who perhaps have not been in the Guard, to get some real leadership? And frankly, most of my friends feel that 2 weeks from the election, this is a pretty weak gubernatorial response. I'll take the response offline. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your question, Pat. Governor?
Well, when you ask what's the real motivation, the real motivation for me is to restore that trust and confidence in Guard members, in their leadership. If it was about the election, then I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily released the report when I did. I kept my promise, and I released it in the middle of an election season when certainly it has damaged, you know, re-election campaign efforts. There's no question about that. Secondly, when working with General Bridges yesterday on, I mean, I'm just going to keep doing what's right to follow this roadmap to change that the National Guard Bureau gave us. I mean, he asked, what about going outside the Guard? Is it appropriate to go to those officers in the Guard? The statute of eligibility for the Adjutant General is what I based our eligibility criteria on. So he said, here's the statute. If you meet the statute, whether you're in the Guard here in Alaska or outside, which includes Army officers and, you know, retired active duty officers, they can qualify for this as well. I said, you can apply. And we had responses from people within the Alaska National Guard, and we had people from outside the Guard that are being considered. Now, certainly the OCI report and the concerns in there about existing leadership certainly will play a role in the decision making. But again, I'm not going to taint or limit who they can look at, as long who the review group can look at with General McGuire, as long as they fit the eligibility criteria from the statute.
Governor Sean Parnell is our guest today on Talk of Alaska. We're going to be talking about a wide range of issues, and we've got callers on the line, but I want to get a question in about oil prices.
Yeah,
they have been dropping quite a bit, and I'm wondering about what that does for the prospect of new development. I was reading in the Barron's Observer yesterday that one economist was saying he feels like he wasn't harsh enough when he expected that oil would drop to $80 a barrel. He's thinking it may drop as low as $60 a barrel. What happens when oil gets to that point? What's the break even, and how will this impact new production incentives if oil keeps dropping the way it is?
Well, first, let me speak to the state revenue side, because I'm not sure all your listeners know that under the new tax regime, under SB 21, we're actually bringing in more state revenue from oil production. So if we were still under ACEs, we'd be making about almost $200 million less than where we are today. So from a state perspective, our revenue has dropped because oil prices have dropped so dramatically. But at this point, thankfully, we're actually bringing in more revenue than we would have. What does it mean for new development? Well, number one, companies take a 30-year perspective or look at things. And so if they believe that that Alaska ANS crude is going to be economic across the next 30 years, not just within this time frame, because we know commodity prices go up and down, they will invest. Now, certainly, as prices are rising, you do tend to see, you know, much more activity, more drilling rigs and the like. But with this new competitive tax regime, we had promises from these companies that they would invest billions more dollars. Now, they did and have been doing a good job of making good on that commitment. Within the last year, we've seen an incredible amount of money and activity on the North Slope. In fact, I rode on the airplane over to Kenai just a couple days ago with a young man who lives in Kenai, works on the slope 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And he told me, again, you just cannot, there's no reason you can't find work on the slope, but also that there are no beds on the slope anymore because so many people are working. And there's a lot of activity. My job is to hold those companies accountable for those billions of dollars they promised. They're making good on that promise thus far, but certainly we'll be watching this with the decline in prices.
It seems like the prospect, you know, it's sort of a catch-22 for Alaska, that if there's lower energy prices overall, that could actually help people in the state, but it doesn't.
Brings down the cost of energy, you know, in rural Alaska and interior Alaska. Clearly that should be coming down. And now, you know, on the other hand, the fuel deliveries were made in August, right? And so that the communities that rely on river system fuel, they've already got theirs at whatever that price was. in August. But still, many Alaskans will receive benefit from lowering gasoline prices, for example.
But I would imagine at some point we're looking at a situation where if this continues, and it looks like there's no end in sight for what's happening in the lower 48, North Dakota has now surpassed mm-hmm. Alaska as an oil producer. The long term, as you said, the long term prospect, are you hearing from the economists that you talk to about how this may impact not only oil production, but the potential for a gas line if prices keep dropping?
Well, no, but I mean, you can imagine that you can imagine a few things. One is that, again, they take that long term view, that 30-year view, and everything we see says that demand for oil will continue to increase for the next 50 years. Then the question then is supply and whether that supply will match it. And with shale oil in the lower 48, certainly we've gotten to that place. But it really is a difficult thing to speculate on. You know, here in 1999 and 2000, I was the co-chair of Senate Finance Committee. So I was responsible for writing the Senate's version of the budget along with my co-chair. And at that point, oil was at $9 a barrel. $9 a barrel. We had a 40% hole in our budget, in our general fund budget. And I can still remember the experts, supposedly the Cambridge Energy Research Associates, experts who stood in front of the Finance Committee and said, the price of oil has fundamentally changed and the markets have fundamentally changed and oil will never again go above $20 a barrel.
Wow.
You know how accurate that was. I mean, it's pretty difficult to predict the price of oil because it is a commodity that fluctuates. And we know that that was not right because oil went to $140 per barrel just a few years back. And so what goes up comes down and what comes down goes up. And that's the revenue that we have to rely on.
All right. We're going to take a caller now from Joanne, a call from Joanne in Homer. Good morning.
Good morning. One thing that I haven't been hearing much about is the people at the bottom of the economic ladder, you know, people on minimum wage, single-parent households, people on fixed income, whether it's retirement or disability, and how they're doing. You know, one thing to point out is that if you're at the bottom of the economic ladder, what your inflation is basically food, energy, and housing. You're not buying the big ticket items, at least not new. If you need a car, it's going to be used. If you need appliances or furniture, they're probably going to be used, if you can get them at all. And I just want to hear about what the governor has done to help the people who perhaps don't have the option of working on the North Slope, the people who don't have a lot of money, who aren't keeping up with inflation, and what he would do to help them in the future.
All right. Thank you, Joanne, for your question, Governor.
Yeah, lots of ways. For instance, with food, energy, housing, let me just pick one. Energy. So when the communities get their fuel deliveries in the fall, many of the communities have to get loans from the state, from the Department of Commerce. But every year, at my direction, the Department of Commerce has made phone calls as part of their Fuel Watch program, I believe it's called, to call communities, let them know what's available for funds, and to remind them to order their fuel if they haven't done so. That in itself has assured that communities with high-cost energy don't get caught in a pinch with low fuel oil stocks, for example, in the community. That's one thing in particular. The same thing comes when it comes to energy in terms of Alaska Energy Authority's work in our communities. I just saw an article by the mayor in St. George who complimented the Alaska Energy Authority for the work they had done on renewable energy source for them and their public buildings, and how that was reducing the cost for everybody in the community. So, lots of means. You know, with the public assistance programs, we have eligibility people, for example, who work to make sure that those who are eligible have access to those public benefits. And so lots of ways that our state employees are working to make sure that the poor who are on public assistance have the assistance that they need, but also with a growing economy comes growing opportunity. So my example of the North Slope job was just illustrative of what's available. And beyond that, I'm offering and championed greater scholarships and needs-based grants for workforce training as well as for college for those who are coming through high school. So there's a range of options and opportunities out there for every Alaskan. My job is to create opportunity for every one of them.
Let's take one more call that in the vein of energy, and then maybe we, after the break, we can move on to other issues. This is Beth in Wasilla, and I believe she has a comment about the state of the gas line. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Governor Parnell, and I want to thank you for your commitment to the Kinnikum Crossing, to diversifying education opportunities, and to building the gas line. I think that will do a lot towards reducing energy costs statewide. Could you give us an update on exactly what the design phase is and whether or not the road that they're putting in will be developable for the future?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, and thanks, Beth, for that question, because we are making, we're in a place we've never been as a state in terms of progress on a large volume gas line. The state is in the driver's seat for our ownership share. We're working in tandem with companies who also are putting down their money. Everybody's aligned, working together, doing real design work, real engineering work on this stage that's called pre-front-end engineering and design. That means kind of that high-level design work. The pipeline has already, the route has already been selected from the North Slope to Nikiski. The guidance documents that we negotiated and we got approved through the legislature assure that that gas will be available to Alaskans and Alaska communities and at the lowest price possible, whether it's the North Slope price or the Cook Inlet price, whichever price happens to be lowest. So looking out for Alaskans that way. What I see happening is work continuing, this engineering and design work continuing for about another 12 to 14, 15 months. They then have to come back to the legislature, say, here's everything we've done, and ask permission from what I call our board of directors, the people from the representatives in the legislature, to move into the front-end engineering and design stage. And what that means is that's the stage where you actually design down to the bolt and valve level. I mean, the real detail, and you nail down all the cost estimates. After that stage comes the final investment decision and then construction. So we're making historic progress. I think we need to continue on this path. It's a path that requires us to be open and transparent with the public and with legislators so that once we do work and with the money that's been allocated, we come back, get held accountable for that work, and then get permission or not to move forward into the next stage of the project.
Governor Sean Parnell is our guest today on Talk of Alaska. We're talking about a wide range of issues. You can join our conversation. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll take your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and Governor Sean Parnell is in the studio with us today. We're talking about a wide range of state issues. The number to join the conversation statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. And if you're calling in the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. And before we return to callers, Governor, I'd like to take a comment from someone who emailed us. This comment says, if a ban on same-sex marriage has been ruled unconstitutional and you have sworn to uphold the Constitution, why are you fighting this ruling?
Let me ask that question with another question. If the freedom of the press had been nullified, you know, as a part of our Constitution by a lower court, would we accept a lower court's ruling on something like that? I mean, it really does come down to me to be, it comes down to the fact that we have a Constitution, we have a vote of the people that ratified every amendment, every piece of that Constitution. And so just because a lower court ruling says something is unconstitutional doesn't mean at that moment we should just let every constitutional provision go to one lower court ruling. Instead, I think we need finality and certainty. Otherwise, there will be folks wondering, was this just a judge, or is it really the law of the land? And the only way to know is to make those appeals on this very important foundational element. So that's the reason for, and I would appeal a lower court ruling on any constitutional provision because of the importance of that foundational structure we have.
All right. Well, we're, as I said, we'll be jumping around from topic to topic, and that's part of the fun of Talk of Alaska. I'm going to take one more email question here, and then we'll return to the phone lines. This is from Sam in Anchorage, and he says, I'm an avid sports fisherman concerned about Pacrim Coal's proposal to mine for coal through a salmon stream. Governor Parnell has stated that he would never trade one resource for another, yet the DNR and Fish and Game continue to deny protections for the Chewitna River. I'm wondering where he personally stands on the issue. That's what Sam wants to know.
To my knowledge, they're not denying any protections to the Chewitna River. There's been no permit that's been issued. There's nothing. I mean, my job as governor, and I'll tell you where I personally stand, is I will not trade one resource for another, and I will uphold our environmental permitting laws. That's my stand. And across the last 5 years, that's what I've done. So to say any different at this point, I think I'd ask, what's the basis? Because there is none.
All right. Yeah. Let's go back to the phone lines. We'll take Chris in Palmer has a comment or question on social issues. Chris, good morning. Oh, Chris left. So we'll instead go to Esther and hear from JD. Good morning, JD.
Good morning, Governor Parnell. I have two questions for you. I'd like a straightforward yes or no answer if I could, because they're very important to my union, which is Local 942 out of Fairbanks. I'd like to know if you support raising the minimum wage in Alaska, and I'd also like to know if you support Davis-Bacon, both in the federal and the state form. Gubernatorial candidate Walker's answer is yes and yes on that. What's yours?
Yes and yes. All right, next question. You bet.
That was easy. All right, let's go to...
We pay little Davis-Bacon wages right now. It's the law of the land. That's where we are. And I'll be voting yes on minimum wage.
All right, yep. That's straightforward, just what JD wanted. Thank you for that. We're going to go to Roberta in Homer now. Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning. yes, I have some questions regarding the suing of the federal government. And I am so glad the federal government has oversight, because I have watched your administration be willing to promote development, in my opinion, at any cost. And so it's been a thank goodness for EPA, especially in regards to the Pebble Mine. The idea that an earthen dam could ever hold back the type of amount of toxins that we're talking about in Crystal Bay makes us know what we're thinking about when you come to earthquake country. But so the suit of EPA and many times, the endangered species, multiple suits, Obamacare, so many people are disenfranchised from medical care now, Hobby Lobby, and the last I checked, the cost was $3 million so far, and that was 3 to 4 months ago, so it must be more. So that's my thought, is just wanting to have some discussion about suing the federal government. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to address that, because I will stand up for Alaskans, whether it's through persuasion, you know, talking across the desk with a secretary, a U.S. cabinet secretary, as I've done most recently in late June, whether I stand up for Alaskans, whether through persuasion or through litigation. And, you know, I'd have to respond back and say one example just recently, under the Endangered Species Act, there was a listing of the bearded seal that we did not believe was based on science. And in fact, the court came back and said that listing was, quote, arbitrary and capricious. So that's one of a number of suits that I don't think we should let our federal government act in an arbitrary and capricious manner. And I will stand up for Alaskans when they do. So we might have disagreements over specific issues, but I hope your listener understands that it is the governor's job to stand up for Alaskans when we think the federal government has overstepped its bounds. That is a natural check and balance that our founders gave us.
Talk of Alaska. We have Governor Sean Parnell with us today, and you can join our conversation if you have questions. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255, or locally in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422. The last caller mentioned a series of things, a lot of different things. One of them was Medicaid. The Medicaid Reform Advisory Group that you put together has been meeting to reform the state's Medicaid system. What is the most productive thing that's come out of those meetings, and would you reconsider your decision not to expand Medicaid?
So I've expressed a willingness to do that if there was something that made sense, something that provided the ability for those at 100% federal poverty level or below to get access to services that they don't already have, but one that also doesn't jeopardize our kids' future by having to pay back billions of dollars in a national debt that's being incurred for services provided today. And that's one of the issues, is I think there's a smarter way to do this. And I've asked the Medicaid Review Advisory Group to tell me that they've looked at it, tell me what the alternatives are to the straight up expansion. And let's have a conversation. It seems like every state that's been early in to the Affordable Care Act's provision has been sorry. So for example, the insurance exchanges, the earliest states to get in, you can see that, I think it was Maryland, was just publicized that they were saddled with between $35 to $55 million more dollars as a state than was originally estimated for, you know, the changing goalposts. And I don't think it's good policy to be early in on something that is so sweeping and broad and has so many ramifications. So I've asked a group of Alaskans to work with me to figure out how this can be done in a smarter, more cost-effective manner.
And are you open to the idea that if they come back and say, you know, we've looked at it and it looks like expansion is the best way to go, would you be willing to do that then?
Well, I'm not going to just say that right now until I see what they've looked at. And a year ago when I formed the Medicaid Review Advisory Group, I asked them to come up with a report by November 15. Haven't seen a draft. Haven't seen what they're doing on that. And then when our analysis of Medicaid expansion was completed in March or April, and I tacked on the additional task of asking this group to evaluate how do we get insurance or coverage for those 10 to 15,000 people in that gap, you know, people who don't have access to the tribal health system, people who don't have access to the VA system, for example. I tacked that on as an additional task of this group. The initial task was help me figure out how to make the existing Medicaid program sustainable. How do we bend the cost curve of it? Because the existing program is not sustainable by any measure. The second task was then, given what we learned in March and April from the report done by Department of Health and Social Services that was released, how do we best provide access to health care for this group for this targeted set of services that they don't have, that they don't currently have free access to?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay with that theme of the Department of Health and Social Services and hear from John in Anchorage. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Lifelong Alaskan. I was born in Kodiak and live everywhere else. Thank you, Governor, for taking my call. My question is about health and social services. I've worked in the industry for about 7 years now, and I've seen a dramatic decline in the quality of services with health and social services and senior and disability services. And I got to say, I think the general consensus in the healthcare, you know, community, with providers all the way down to participants, is that the government, the current government, doesn't want to grow the government in these areas. And I think that's not a wise decision, because baby boomers are still here, and the rate of disabled Alaskans is just going up, up, and up. And I'm talking about legitimate disabled Alaskans. That trajectory is still going up. So I want to hear from you specifically, without tying it into energy, please, how you plan to improve health and social services and all the sub-agencies below, how you plan to improve the quality of services and deal with the increase in intake that every statistic seems to suggest that we will be facing.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And when it comes to senior and disability services, I actually think that's such a broad topic that it would be great, I think, if your program here would have on somebody like Dwayne Mays, who heads up that division for the Department of Health and Social Services. But from a big picture perspective, one of those key areas that we are short on is assisted living facilities, and kind of that transition from well living and independent living into assisted living and end of life type care. There are a lot of models around, but I've basically proposed to move us in a direction where the state will provide incentives to get more assisted living facilities here in the state, whether it's purely private, whether it's private and public in a partnership. And that's something that I intend to pursue across the next 4 years, is to increase that. Now, we've done some of that already through the tribal healthcare system in places like Manilik and in Kotzebue and Bethel and Nome, and also with ANTHC here in Anchorage, with some more beds and housing available here for that kind of care. But we do have what they call a silver tsunami. I mean, I'm kind of a little bit a part of that. I've got a little bit of silver kind of coming in my hair. But we have an aging population. Each one of us has parents that we'd like to take care of, or elders that we need to take care of. And this is a big conversation that we're going to be having as a state, and a big direction as well for our state. Now, again, I'd encourage you to have a discussion with Dwayne Mays on senior and disability services, and specifically why the gentleman thinks there's been a decline. I mean, certainly on the other side of the equation, on the Medicaid side of the equation, we've had huge issues with Xerox as a vendor, you know, with a new Medicaid management system that they put in place about a year ago. We've taken all the remedy under the contract. You know, we've provided, we did mediation with them. Now we filed a claim against them to get them to make that management system work and make it right. So there are definitely issues within health and social services, no question, and we're working to remedy them. But on the specific topic of senior disability services, Dwayne Mays is the guy to have in here.
All right. Thank you, Governor, for that. We're going to take a question now from our email questions. And this is someone who wrote in that says, as a woman, the cost of pregnancy and raising a child can be financially prohibitive. Therefore, unrestricted and affordable access to birth control is integral to women's economic security and independence. What legislation would you support or what regulations would you introduce to ensure unrestricted and affordable access to birth control? And I should mention that she's making a link to independence from batterers, so from bad relationships.
So you have to correct me if I'm wrong, Lori, but I understand that there is access to birth control through the public health centers in across the state. And I guess the question is maybe broader than that, and I'd have to get clarification on it. But I think that's the answer is if you cannot afford birth control, go to your public health centers and they will make it available to you.
All right. I think maybe she was just wanting to know if you're supportive of that idea. There's been a lot of controversy nationally about whether or not birth control should be widely available. What's your thoughts on that generally?
Well, yes. I mean, generally, when we're speaking of contraception, yes. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's take a totally different topic. This is a caller.
You're taking a wide range today, aren't you, Lori?
Yes. This is a caller in Fairbanks who has a question. George in Fairbanks has a question on Prop 2. Good morning, George.
Hello, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know what your stance is, first off, on Prop 2, and if it'll have any effect, or if the effect, if any, on the abnormally high rates of alcoholism and incarceration in the Alaska Native population.
So I'm a no vote on Prop 2, which is the marijuana initiative. And for one of the reasons is I think you're right. I think it will have an impact just like alcohol does. But frankly, I'm more concerned about the message it sends to our kids that marijuana is okay. And we know what that does to young people. It diminishes their initiative. Any trouble they're already having is exacerbated when they try to escape those troubles by getting high, and grades slip, initiative slips, and it goes downhill from there. And any time that we try to say it's okay for our kids to go into, I'll just call it an alternate reality, you know, to escape that way, we actually are cutting off opportunities from them. Beyond the physical changes that can occur in a really young person that diminish brain development and the like. And I think about this because I'm thinking about, I'm going to transition back to our economy, because we have an economy that is estimated to have about 125,000 new jobs available across the next 8 years. 4 out of 5 of those jobs are going to require a skilled laborer, somebody with a certificate in a particular trade. Most of those trades are going to require a blood or urine test to be on the job. Marijuana stays in your system for 30 days. These kids are going to come out of school. One of my initiatives is career technical training to get them their certificate while they're in high school, as they graduate from high school. Then we're saying it's okay to smoke pot, and they're going to be in the workplace and lose their job, because on the one hand we're saying it's okay, on the other hand we're testing, and I just think it sends the wrong message to our kids and sets them up for failure in the end. So I'm a no on 2, and pretty clearly so.
All right. Thank you, George, for that question. We are going to take a short break, and we'll have more questions for Governor Sean Parnell as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We've got Governor Sean Parnell in the studio today, and we have a bunch of callers on the line. So let's work through a few of those. And let's take first Helen in Seward, who wants to know about Alaskans and the pipeline. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning, Helen.
Yes, Governor Purnell, I would like to know if you are going to put a larger than what we have had before amount of Alaskans to work when we build and run the pipeline.
Absolutely. And here's what I've already done about that. So you're speaking about the gas line. And in the 8K LNG project, there were a set of documents known as guidance documents that were put in public at the beginning of the legislative session. The legislature read through those documents. The public had access to them. Those guidance documents, they direct our path on every other agreement that's made, every step we take in this gas line. Those documents assured local hire of Alaskans as well as local buying from Alaska vendors. So that is our primary goal, is Alaska hire. It's directed in the documents in terms of how we go about and what we're requiring as part of that. Certainly, we can't require anything that's unconstitutional, but the companies are on notice, and those provisions, local hire provisions, are written in, just as are provisions for gas, Alaska's gas for Alaskans, making sure that there are at least 5 offtakes for Alaskans and our communities of that gas. So, yes, Alaska hire is a huge priority of mine. It's written into the guidance documents that have been approved and that we're moving forward under.
All right. Thank you, Helen, for that call.
Do we have a percentage, though?
We can't mandate a percentage, but my goal is 100%.
When the oil line went through, they hired out of Louisiana more than they did Alaska, so it concerned me.
Well, and part of the answer there, Helen, requires us to train up more of our workers, and to have more of our young people involved. So 2 weeks ago, I made a pretty bold proposal, and I said, when a kid graduates from high school, why do we just give them a diploma? Why couldn't they also earn a certificate in a skill or trade? We do that on a limited basis in a few places in this state, but we need to give more kids that opportunity. Similarly, why not give them the chance to graduate from high school with a high school diploma and a 2-year associate's degree if they want, so they're ready for the workforce in another area that requires an AA? So I'm working to make sure that we have more Alaskans available and trained to hire as we move towards this gas line.
All right. Thank you, Helen, for your call and your questions. We're going to take a call from Richard in Homer. Good morning, Richard.
Hi. Yeah, I was hearing about how Norway takes so good care of its people from oil taxes, and I was thinking about Sarah Palin and how she helped get a good fair oil tax going. And I'm wondering why you would turncoat on Alaska and Alaskans and give up maybe $2 or more billion of potential income that we could be receiving for our state when our state is facing such hard times economically, possibly.
Well, I'll go back to what I said earlier in the show, and we have a disagreement here on SB 21, the bill that passed that the people actually ratified as going forward. But let me just tell you that today, when oil prices are in that $82 per barrel range or $80 a barrel range, we are making more money as a state under SB 21 and the More Alaska Production Act than we would have been under ACES. We're making almost $200 million more now than if we would have stuck with the old system. So the notion of a giveaway is totally false. And actually today, we're bringing in more money. So that's just pure fact with where we are.
Well, Governor, there are other folks that would like to talk to you, but I want to get in a question here in our last few minutes about AFN is in town, Alaska Federation of Natives. There's thousands of Native folks who are in the city for this week. What's the status of the state working on the issue of, it's a perennial issue, law enforcement? We've talked about energy, but let's talk a little bit about law enforcement in rural Alaska. Yeah. There's a big need, as you well know. What are you looking forward to? If the people send you back to Juneau, how will that be part of what you're looking at going forward, and what are some plans that may be in place for that?
Well, one every Alaskan deserves to be safe in their homes. That's fundamentally what this is about. And one of the shortcomings of law enforcement in our rural communities is that there are communities without law enforcement, with nobody present to help. So some of our communities in this state, a person can call for help, and especially if weather's bad, not only do they have to wait for an airplane to get there with a trooper in it, you know, from Bethel, for example, but they might have to wait several days for help, and by then it is too late. And so I made a promise when I came into office that I would work to increase the level of funding and the number of officers, village public safety officers, in the communities that don't have them. My recollection is that in 2006 or 2007, the number of VPSOs was around 46 to 49 VPSOs. Since that time, we've added just about 15 every year since I came into office, since 2010. And we have more than doubled that in terms of the number of funded positions. We were over 100 at one point in terms of funded, filled positions. We've slipped some because of the it's pretty hard to retain VPSOs in those communities. So right now we have open positions. We're actively trying to get people in those positions, but those positions are filled by the nonprofits in the region. So, for instance, Tanana Chiefs or other tribal organizations in the regions, they're the ones that contract for the VPSOs, and the state gives those tribal entities the money to do it. So we're working to, in coordination and partnership with them, to recruit VPSOs, because we need more to step forward and to keep these communities safe. Secondly, we're working. We've negotiated an agreement with some tribal courts to take on some alcohol cases and potentially a first-time domestic violence case as well. We're waiting for signatures on those agreements. Haven't gotten a signature yet, but made good faith efforts and good faith negotiations to get them. And still waiting to hear from some communities in the Tanana Chiefs area, as well as CAIC, I believe. So not only are we making progress on putting VPSOs into communities that didn't have it before, making progress in culturally relevant tribal court proceedings as well.
All right. Well, thank you, Governor Sean Parnell, for being with us on Talk of Alaska today. It was a lively discussion, as it usually is. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and on the phones, Annie Fite and Ashley Snyder. Tomorrow, the independent challenger for the gubernatorial race, Bill Walker, will be here for an additional Talk of Alaska this week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.